From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Robin Young and Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And let's start with heightened concerns over terrorism as authorities are boosting security for 4th of July celebrations across the country. This follows recent terrorist attacks in Tunisia, Kuwait, and France. Here's Congressman Peter King, a member of the House Homeland Security Committee, on Fox News.
I would say since September 11th, this is the most concerned I've seen the FBI and Homeland Security and the local police.
Well, Seth Jones is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND, and he joins us now. And Seth, your thoughts on what we just heard. Do you think Congressman King is right?
Well, Congressman King obviously follows the issue very closely. I would just say two things. One is that we have seen high levels of threat in the past, particularly in 2009, when there were several near misses, including the underwear bomber, and authorities were very concerned. But second, what we're seeing, regardless of the July 4th holiday, is a high level of interest by ISIS in conducting an attack. So I do think we are seeing a very serious increase in the threat level, particularly from ISIS.
Mm. But is there a history of terrorist attacks on specific dates or significant holidays?
The vast majority of attacks we've seen overseas, particularly in the West over the past decade or so, indicates that most terrorists and terrorist groups simply try to conduct attacks when they are able to and on targets that are accessible. So occasionally we'll see an effort to strike on a specific date, but it's very rare. And I think in this case, the broader concern is not a July 4th holiday weekend, but the broader concern is increases in interest by ISIS to either inspire attacks or to get involved themselves.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about that. Why is that increasing interest happening now in ISIS?
Well, there appear to be two major reasons why ISIS is increasingly interested. One is it is expanding its presence outside of Iraq and Syria, almost a dozen locations from Libya and other locations in North Africa, all the way to South Asia, including Afghanistan and Pakistan. And in a number of those areas, it has come across the United States, which has conducted attacks against its key leadership. The second issue is we've seen people listening listening to ISIS and its call for attacks in the West. So we've seen attacks in Sydney, Australia, Paris, France, Tunisia, and even in places like Garland, Texas. And over the last couple of months, plots that have been thwarted from New York to Minneapolis and San Diego. So people appear to be listening more than they have in the past.
So listening to ISIS for some sort of cue that now's the time for an attack?
Listening at this point really to ISIS. What ISIS has done in its propaganda. I mean, it's very active on the social media front and very active in on the internet and putting out internet publications. And what it does in publications like Dabiq, which is one of its online English language publications, is it encourages people in the West, including the United States, to strike easy targets and to do it without putting together sophisticated plots, but really these kind of armed assaults that we saw in the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, people just picking up a gun and shooting it or putting together a really simple improvised explosive device like what we saw, say, in Boston at the marathon. And that's the kind of thing it's inspiring people to do.
And finally, Seth, I mean, if we are dealing with individual extremists or terrorists who are just waiting for the right kind of inspiration, I mean, what kind of challenges does that pose for law enforcement, you know, both at the federal and even the state or local level?
Well, with the new kind of terrorism that we're seeing, including in the United States, and that comes from extremist religious groups, but it also comes from extremist right-wing and other kinds of organizations, it becomes increasingly difficult to find these people before they attack if they're not members of a group, if they're simply inspired. And as we've already seen across the West, this is in the U.S., we've heard the British and French intelligence agencies and authorities talk about this. They simply do not have, nor do they expect to have in the foreseeable future, the resources to identify all of these plots before they occur. They'll get many of them. They'll probably get most of them. But it is simply impossible to have the resources to identify every single person, even the inspired ones interested in plotting attacks. And that is the real operational challenge that the West faces right now.
Seth Jones is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. Seth, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, Seth Jones mentioned Tunisia. That's where 38 people were killed in an ISIS attack a week ago. 30 of the victims were British. And today in the UK, flags flew at half-staff and the nation observed a moment of silence. The BBC's diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus joins us from London. And Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit more about how the Tunisian attack is resonating there?
Well, it's had a significant impact here. Of course, today at noon, there was the one-minute silence, respected by everybody, very visibly by Her Majesty the Queen, David Cameron, the Prime Minister, and, of course, others. In local areas where some of the victims came from, for example, outside Sandwell Council offices, which is in the West Midlands, near Birmingham. One of the victims had worked there, and the mayor and hundreds of people gathered to mark the minute's silence. And of course, indeed, we've also had today the third repatriation of bodies of the victims flown back by a Royal Air Force aircraft. And those ceremonies have been shown on the television each day, very somber. Clearly, there are still more victims to come. So it's had a significant impact.
So how then is the British government considering responding, if at all?
The Prime Minister, David Cameron, has spoken about a full spectrum response. Now, that clearly has security aspects, looking at security both in Tunisia and at places like that, which are frequented by large numbers of British holidaymakers, but also, of course, security back home in London and elsewhere. It's once again reopened the whole debate about radicalisation Muslims, British Muslims who are living here. Yet again, a rather large Muslim family from Luton, a small town to the north of London, have been apparently gone off to Syria, lock, stock and barrel, to back Islamic State. So that's given that whole debate about radicalisation, how you combat that and so on, an additional edge. And of course, also, lastly, the government is beginning to talk again about the possibility of Britain's air operations in the Middle East being extended, not just to take in Iraq, where British aircraft are already involved, but also potentially to bomb targets in Syria, too. Mm.
Well, we have a little bit of tape from British Defense Secretary Michael Fallon on exactly this point, speaking in the House of Commons yesterday.
We know that ISIL is organized and directed from northern Syria. That's why the Prime Minister said during the debate last September on taking military action in Iraq that, and I quote, there is a strong case for us to do more in Syria.
Of course, ISIL, also known as ISIS. But Jonathan, I'm curious, does Prime Minister Cameron have support for this kind of military expansion amongst members of Parliament?
I think there is growing support. It's difficult to judge quite yet how the balance would lie. Clearly, in Britain, you don't need parliamentary approval to embark on this kind of action. But clearly, in the wake of the failed effort by the government back in 2013 to get approval for airstrikes against forces linked with President Assad, if you remember when President Assad had used chemical weapons and there were lots of calls that there should be punitive strikes against the Assad regime, parliamentarians refused to give the government backing for that. This time, therefore, I think there will have to be a parliamentary approval. And I think the comments you heard there from the Defence Secretary, Michael Fallon, are very much beginning to prepare the way. But importantly there, he talked about Islamic State, ISIL, however you want to call it, being organised and directed from northern Syria. And that rather underscores that there needs to be a sound legal justification to underpin any decision to actually mount airstrikes in Syria as well.
Mm. And finally, Jonathan, amongst the British people, over the past many years, there's been this enormous divide, a great deal of debate over the threat of terrorism. I mean, I know that there was a whole diversity of opinion about Britain's participation in the Iraq War. And then, of course, now we've got, as you mentioned earlier, seems to be the increasing threat or increasing appearance of a threat of homegrown terrorism in the UK. And we're talking on a day where bodies are being returned from Tunisia. I'm wondering what the opinion of the British people is for some kind of expanded military action elsewhere in the Middle East, and whether or not they believe it would have any effect on increasing safety in the UK.
I don't think there is a clamour for military action in Syria. For one thing, I think people have quite a reasonable understanding that Britain's military resources are limited. Most people here are saying this would be a pinprick. It wouldn't really make a significant difference. It would be just a symbolic step more than anything else. So it is a very, very difficult debate that in some ways is only beginning to be had.
Jonathan Marcus is the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, speaking to us from London. Jonathan, thank you.
No, thank you. A pleasure.
Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is calling on voters to reject a proposed bailout of the country. And in a televised address today, he said the upcoming referendum is not a vote on whether Greece will stay in the euro. But tell that to Greece's creditors, who have a very different message, this on the last day of campaigning ahead of Sunday's vote. Martin Sanbu of the Financial Times joins us from London to explain. Martin, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
First of all, can you tell us what current opinion polls are saying about how Greeks think about the referendum at this point?
The last thing I've seen is that the polls are very, very close, about 43-44% on each side for no and for yes. Now, as you probably know, the referendum question is quite complex. It refers to financial documents and so on. So it's not surprising that as various news comes out, the Greeks will reinterpret the question and change their minds.
Well, interesting, because today Prime Minister Tsipras, as we've said earlier, has insisted that Sunday's referendum is not a vote on whether or not Greece will remain in the euro. So, you know, say voters do end up rejecting the bailout, what would that mean for Greece and the euro?
I think it's very hard to say. And what you see is the politics of this is all about defining what the question actually means. It's clear that the government simply wants to interpret a no as a signal that they should take a harder stance against the creditors. The creditors, for self-interested reasons, want to say, no, if it's no, then you're out of the euro, so vote yes. But that doesn't actually tell us what the Greeks themselves think when they go into the ballot box. We know that a large majority of Greeks say they want to stay in the euro. So clearly the referendum polling doesn't actually reflect their opinion on that.
And how is it that the rest of Europe is looking upon this moment about what might happen on Sunday?
I think there are two things going on. One is that you see an expression of exasperation. The Greek government is a bit of a tough crowd to negotiate with. They reject a lot of what's been the consensus in terms of how to handle the crisis in the eurozone. In some respects, it's quite right to reject parts of that consensus because the crisis hasn't been well handled at all. Another set of reactions are, of course, very political. It makes sense for the creditors to say, if you say no, there'll be no deal, you're on your own. That doesn't mean that on Monday they will actually say, well, let's just cut Greece off, even if it does vote no. I think the referendum is just one more step in this very long, tiring process. It's probably not going to be the final word either way.
And now we also see that the IMF, in presenting a new review, says that an even bigger rescue package is what's needed to help Greece. First of all, why is that? And why is the IMF saying that now?
Well, I think the IMF is finally telling the truth. Most people who follow this have known this for quite some time. The IMF internally has been very clear. They are probably saying it now partly to wash their hands of what might happen. They will say, well, we always said this was unsustainable, or at least we said it eventually. It might be some attempt at pressuring the other European creditors to come around to this view that whatever the final deal will be, if there is one, it will have to include some sort of debt relief. But I think we'll know much more on Monday or Tuesday what this really means.
Martin Sanbu is economics writer for the Financial Times. He's speaking to us from London. Martin, thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's sorry, Mo, the best thing I can say is that we have no idea what will happen, but I think that's the situation.
Now to the U.S., where the Census Bureau finds that about 4,000 houses of worship close close every year. Today we have the story of one of them. After serving the Jewish community in Revere, Massachusetts for 103 years, Congregation Tiferet Israel is closing. Recently, synagogue members, past and present, returned to reclaim parts of their family histories and recall enduring memories. Bruce Gellerman from Here and Now contributor WBUR has our story.
On the outside, Congregation Tiferet Israel on Nahant Street in Revere, Massachusetts, is a sad sight. The synagogue's chimney collapsed years ago. The roof is caving in. Inside, it's a different story.
Isn't that remarkable? I've never seen anything like that.
Elizabeth Berman is one of the few certified Judaica appraisers in the country. She walks around the shul, marveling at the details.
It really is quite lovely. The wood, the columns are lovely. They're sculpted. Very nice, very nice.
A wood beam ceiling soars high overhead, a gap between heaven and earth, and space enough for two balconies. Women sat upstairs, separate from men, as was the custom of the Orthodox Jews who fled Lithuania at the turn of the 20th century and founded Congregation Tiferet Israel in 1912. The pews are solid oak. Two gold-leaf lions stand atop the mahogany sacred ark, all hand-carved by local craftsmen.
A lot of the stuff is wonderful. Look at that pendant under the chandelier. It has a rosette with an inscription in it. I think would find a lot of interest on the auction market, or certainly for a historical society or a Jewish museum.
What can be salvaged before this building is demolished will be reclaimed by those who still remember Tiferet Israel as a vibrant place of worship, or sold at auction, the money used to maintain the synagogue's two cemeteries.
This menorah, we donated for my dad, memory of my dad, and when he passed on, so that's something that will be taken.
Ira Novoleski's father once served as vice president of the congregation. For the past decade, Ira has been president, and he'll be the last.
I've just been keeping it going as long as I can. Now I can't. We can't afford it anymore. We ran out of money. We just don't have the membership of the 30 members that we have. If we have 10 that actually live in Revere, is a lot. When the families left, they left.
In the mid-20th century, a quarter of the city's population was Jewish, and there were three synagogues. Soon, there'll be just one.
When I was a kid, this would be filled. There'd be people outside waiting. The streets would be blocked off.
73-year-old Bill Lippman is vice president of the synagogue.
There's another one over on Walnut Ave that is now Spanish Church. It had been a shul. And as kids, we'd go from this one to that one to this one. You'd have everybody there.
The Exodus began in the 1960s, a familiar immigrant story. Jews who created a cultural enclave in Revere, Massachusetts, prospered and assimilated.
Families that moved in here in the 30s, 40s, want their children to move out to Newton, down to Sharon, up to Peabody. All right? Always do better than what your parents did. That's the whole idea. Up and out.
Lippman calls the closing of Congregation Tiferet Israel a sad success story. For the past 5 years, the synagogue has had only enough money to hold services on the high holy days. Daily prayers ended long before. Members couldn't find 10 men to make up a minyan, the minimum needed. Women were permitted to participate, but it didn't help. Ira Novoleski even tried a minyan hunter.
We had a minion hunter here who, if we needed a minion during the week, he'd go outside. If he saw a Jewish kid or even a non-Jewish kid sometimes, he'd say, come, come, minion, minion.
And bring him in.
And bring him in so we have 10 so they can say Kaddish downstairs.
Kaddish, the mourner's prayer, is an obligation no longer fulfilled at Tiferet Israel. The synagogue's executive committee made the difficult decision not to delay the inevitable. The call went out to those who had memorial plaques on the walls honoring family members who had died. Come claim them. Bill Lippman uses a screwdriver to remove Yortzeit memorial plaques bearing lifetimes of memories for Pam Presson.
We have a plaque for my father, Jack Presson. We have a plaque for my grandmother, his mother, his sister, and, you know, people we grew up with.
The metal plaques bear witness to Cones and Silvermans, Blotniks, Sokolovs, Meltzers, and more. Pam Presson left Revere decades ago, but holding the memorial plaques in her hands, the memories of the shul and Jewish community center just down the block rush back.
At the JCC, I took Hebrew school, but then I quit so I could see the Beatles cartoons on Saturday. I didn't want to go to the temple.
For many congregants, the real rock star was a rabbi who presided over Tiferet Israel for nearly half a century.
Rabbi Landis, very famous, very famous.
Temple president Ira Novoleski.
He has the iconic photograph walking on Revere Beach with the sun shining on him. He's a tall guy. He was about 6'4". And he had this long white beard.
Oh, my God. He was an icon.
Susan Peck grew up in Revere. Now a judge in Connecticut, she also remembers Rabbi Landis.
He would, you know, always wear a hat and a long black coat. And he had the most incredible gray beard. And he was revered. I mean, literally, you know, I don't mean to pun on the name Revere, but I mean this, but he was revered by everyone.
As the Revere Temple closes, the memories flow from the sacred to the sublime. Oy, the food, latkes, knishes, and bagels to die for.
I remember at Schwartz's Delicatessen, they had hand-cut Romanian pastrami, and it's never been replicated.
Revere's kosher restaurants and bakeries are long gone. Today, there are bodegas, Asian stores, and halal markets. But Ira Novoleski had hoped the synagogue, which started as a Methodist church long ago, could have seen new life as a mosque.
I talked to the imam and I told him, I said, imam, you know, it's a perfect spot for you. It holds over 400 people in here. The problem is when 450 people come, you will have 400 cars. Where are we going to put them around here? You know, we have no parking here. And he was very common sensible and he says, Ira, you're right.
Soon, the building that was the sacred home to generations of European Jews that settled in Revere, Massachusetts, will be no more. Tiferet Israel is to be demolished. But in the hearts and minds of those old enough to recall are memories of prayers for a better life that were answered. For here and now, I'm Bruce Gellerman.
The Chinese stock market today continued what is now an unprecedented slide, down nearly 30% from a 7-year high the market hit just 3 weeks ago. So what effect could China's slide have on global markets? Li Jin is a professor of finance at Oxford University and Peking University. He joins us now from Beijing. And Professor Jin, first of all, what is driving this decline?
There are a lot of speculations about what's going on. I think a lot of the Chinese investors blame the government for not taking more proactive measures to protect the market from rapid decline. At the same time, there were some suggesting that, well, maybe it's the foreign investors. They got in and they tried to take us down. But I think at a more fundamental level, a lot of the investors lately have been trading on margin accounts. They lever up their positions, and therefore, even a small move of the stock price could cause many of these people to be forced to leave the market at large loss, and those could potentially trigger potential price instability in the near future.
This has echoes of 2008 in the United States.
It does, yes. There has been new mechanism introduced to short the stock index, and a lot of new investors flooded into the market in the last 12 months because the market has been booming. So many people were inexperienced. They have a lot of new tools to play with. Many people are not good at using those tools, and they got caught in the middle of this.
So, Professor, though, I'm curious. I mean, you said, yes, this does have echoes of 2008 in the United States. And, of course, the collapse of the U.S. markets then triggered an economic recession virtually worldwide. I mean, could this similar drop in the Chinese markets now have an effect on markets globally?
Well, it could potentially, but I don't think the likelihood is very high. The Chinese economic growth accounts for, I think, a very significant proportion of the global economic growth, if you look at the GDP growth in China. At the same time, the Chinese stock market accounts for a smaller percentage of the overall Chinese economic activities. There are much less Chinese firms listed on the Chinese stock market than there is U.S. firms listed on the U.S. stock market. So even though the price is not pretty on the stocks, this is going to a much less extent affect the financing of Chinese real economic activities.
What does this say about the delicate balance, for lack of a better term, between the Chinese government and its continuously growing free market capitalism in the country?
I like the way you put it. It's a delicate balance. On one hand, the Chinese government takes it as its own responsibility to stabilize the financial market. On the other hand, they don't know, you know, how to deal with the market and the market signal. So when they see the price crash, the government actually were trying everything they could to save the market, to bail it out. For example, there has been discussions about, well, we're going to find out who are the people who are shorting the stocks, and we may have to take some actions against them. Well, that kind of mentality is actually against the free market spirit that the very party is trying to embrace.
Well, Li Jin is professor of finance at Oxford and Peking University. He's speaking to us from Beijing. Professor Jin, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Beachgoers in North Carolina are understandably cautious after several recent shark attacks there. But for a 21-year-old Australian, sharks are not to be feared. Madison Stewart loved the sharks of the Great Barrier Reef ever since she was a child. And at the age of 14, she devoted herself full-time to shark conservation. Since then, she's traveled the world advocating for sharks and swimming with them. Madison Stewart's story is told in the film Shark Girl, which airs on the Smithsonian Channel next week. We spoke to her last June when Shark Girl was first released.
I never really remember falling in love with sharks. It's just always been there. And I guess one of the cool things is that people are scared of them. You know, they implant that fear into people that no other animal can do that.
Well, I mean, that's exactly why I guess people are wondering why you felt drawn to be close to them, to spend as much time in the water with them. Because, like you said, most people kind of respond by wanting to swim away.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when you hear that alarm at the beach and people want to run out of the water, I want to get in. It's because I grew up with an unbiased view of sharks, and I got to meet them, and I got to see what they're really like. And nothing is more peaceful to me than being in the water with them. I spent more time of my childhood with them than I did with people, so a shark interaction was more comfortable for me, I guess.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about sort of the lengths that you go to or have gone to in order to spend as much time as you can, you know, with these honestly truly magnificent creatures, because you decided to be homeschooled when you were, what, 14? Was that right, 14 years
old? Yes.
So you could devote yourself more to shark conservation?
Yeah, my dad and I made a joint decision that I would leave school and start homeschooling, and we would devote our life to doing what we wanted to do, which was diving with sharks. But it was just after that, and we went back to the spots I saw as a kid, and that's when I noticed a decline in shark populations. So that's when things really kind of turned for me.
Yeah, well, so hang on to that thought about the decline in the population for a moment, because digging a little bit more here for you to share the physical, mental, emotional experience of what it's like to be in the water with them.
Yeah.
I mean, can you describe to us, what does it actually feel like?
It feels like being a superhero. It's more normal to me than anything else. You know, I only learned to ride a push bike about 2 years ago because my dad never let me have one as a kid, because apparently it was too dangerous to ride a bike on the road. So, you know, stuff like that is abnormal to me. But swimming with sharks, it's like playing with your puppy dog. I mean, even there's a scene in the film where I'm feeding sharks and everyone's like dramatic about the scene where a shark accidentally bites my hand and I've got chainmail on. But that's what happens when you're playing tug of war with your dog and your dog accidentally bites your hand.
Except I would note that most dogs don't have the ability to completely crush the bones in your hand or have teeth that cycle through for their entire lives, right?
Yeah, I guess.
But I take your point in terms of your relationship with these animals. Now, let's talk about the fact for just a moment that sharks are amongst the most prehistoric creatures in the oceans, right?
Yes, and more than 400 million years old.
I mean, that fact in and of itself is remarkable, and it makes the additional fact that 90% or so of the world's sharks have disappeared just tragic to me.
Yes, sharks have survived major extinctions on this planet before, so it's really a testament to how dangerous we are as a species if in the last 100 years we've managed to nearly wipe them off the oceans.
And so this 90% reduction is exclusively due to humans fishing them and killing them?
Yes. We take 100 million sharks a year. I mean, they're killed for things like shark finning and just shark fisheries and general people's hatred of them. And they're not like fish. You know, they grow like dolphins. They take a really long time to reach the proper age where they can have pups. And then they take a long time to pup and have few young. So they're not the kind of animal that just bounces back straight away. And there are vast areas of our ocean that have lost their sharks for good.
Hmm. In the film, there's a moment from marine biologist Richard Fitzpatrick, who talks about the fact that sharks, they're at the top of the food of the marine food chain. And this vast reduction in the number of sharks in the oceans has really had an effect on marine ecosystems, basically the loss of these apex predators. So let's listen to what Richard Fitzpatrick has to say about that.
Removal of apex predators out of an ecosystem has dramatic effects. It's like driving down the highway with a blindfold on and taking your hands off the steering wheel. You won't crash straight away, but a crash is going to happen.
In your dives, have you seen what the effect of the loss of the sharks has had on marine ecosystems?
Yes. It was first the sharks went, and then the fish went, and then the reef got covered in algae, and now it's almost impossible to find life in some areas. I had read about it, but I never truly knew how devastating it could be, especially to happen in my lifetime. I was 14 years old.
14. Wow.
Yes.
Well, we can hear your passion for the conservation of these animals loud and clear. But Madison, if I could, I do want to just ask you a couple more questions about how you actually interact with sharks while you're in the water. Because, I mean, in the film, we see you feeding them in the Bahamas with shark expert Stuart Cove. And you also do this thing. I mean, you basically, like... I don't know if this is the right way to describe it, but you charm them. I mean, Stuart says you put them into a state of tonic immobility.
Yes, I don't think there is any way to really describe it.
Well, what is that?
It's a beautiful interaction with sharks. No one really knows why it happens. It's still a scientific mystery. But flipping a shark upside down often reverses the center of gravity, releases serotonin into the brain. And the same is replicated in tonic when we've got metal on our hands and we're rubbing the sensory organs on the front of the shark's nose, and that kind of sends them into this overdrive. And it's something we can only do with sharks that we've been feeding for like 30 years. And that's my favorite thing about those feeds is putting sharks in a tonic and filming it, because, you know, you see someone with a shark in their hands rubbing it like you would your dog's belly. It's really quite amazing for people to see that.
In the film, we also see you and Stuart giving first aid to sharks and also visiting places where shark watching rather than fishing them is becoming a growing tourist attraction. Do you think that we can overcome what, you know, as you described earlier, is, and a lot of people, just a primal, if irrational, fear? I mean, that's kind of what drives a lot of people's attitudes about sharks.
Yeah, you know, that and Jaws.
And Jaws, yeah.
It's fine to be scared of sharks. All I ask from people is respect and understanding of the species. Your fear does actually have an impact on what happens to them. So, you know, I think it's cool to be scared of them. It's cool that these animals that we can't control still exist in our oceans, you know, living dinosaurs. It's okay to be scared of them. We can still want to help them, you know?
That's shark girl Madison Stuart. We spoke to her last June, and there's more about her at hereandnow.org. On this day, July 3rd, in 1776, John Adams wrote two letters to his wife Abigail about goings-on in Philadelphia, where the Continental Congress was meeting. Adams and the other founding fathers were setting the stage for independence from Britain, which they would declare publicly the next day when they adopted the text of Thomas Jefferson's declaration and sent it to the printer. These days, the 4th of July is the day we celebrate independence, of course. But as Here and Now's Alex Ashlock reports, when John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail, he believed the celebration should happen on a different day.
As the founding fathers gave birth to the nation, they had their eyes on the future, and they knew they were making history. But John Adams believed July 2nd, 1776, was really the big day in that history.
I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival.
That's Peter Drummy, librarian at the Massachusetts Historical Society. He's reading from one of the letters Adams wrote to Abigail about what had happened on July 2nd, 1776. That was the day the Continental Congress voted for independence, approving a resolution that said, "These United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, and as such, they have and of right ought to have full power to make war, conclude peace, establish commerce, and do all the other acts and things which other states may rightfully do." And of the day the Continental Congress took that action, John wrote to Abigail,
"It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore."
Which is, of course, exactly what happens now on the 4th of July, not the 2nd. So John Adams, who was right about so much, was also right about the way we would celebrate independence, just not the date. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Writer Brad Meltzer is best known for political thrillers like The President's Shadow, but he's also author of a series of children's books called Ordinary People Change the World. They tell the stories of famous people like Abraham Lincoln, aviatrix Amelia Earhart, and civil rights activist Rosa Parks, and what they were like as children. We spoke to Brad Meltzer last year, and he told us that the ideas for the books came from his own family.
It really started because I would say to my daughter, Amelia Earhart flew across the Atlantic. And you know what my daughter says to that? Big deal. Everyone flies across the Atlantic these days, right? But if I tell my daughter that when Amelia Earhart was just 7 years old, is a true story, that she built a homemade roller coaster in her backyard. She took a wooden crate. She put roller skating wheels on the bottom. She shoved it to the roof of her tool shed. She put two giant 2x4s down from the roof to the ground. And then she came careening down in this cart with these roller skating wheels, crashes into the bottom, gets up and says, "That was awesome." Now, to my daughter, Amelia Earhart isn't some black and white figure from a history book. Amelia Earhart is alive, and she's brave, and most important, she's fun.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to do, is take those very ordinary moments from when they're little and show you how they built that into something that really was extraordinary.
There's a similarly powerful moment sort of early in the life of Abraham Lincoln that you write about that has to do with an interaction he had with children who were being cruel to turtles.
When Abraham Lincoln was just 10 years old, he came upon a group of boys playing with turtles. And young Lincoln loved animals when he was little, so he races over to the boys all excited, and he sees that the boys aren't playing with the turtles. They're torturing them. They're putting hot coals on the backs of the turtles to make them run faster. And in that moment, Abraham Lincoln, as a boy, has to figure out what to do. And when I read that story with my little boy, I have a little six-year-old at home, and even when he was five and the book first came out, he would say, "Dad, I want to be like him." Because he understood what it was like to stand up to those bullies and say, "Take those coals off the turtles." And he saved those turtles that day in real life. And my son sees that and is just completely moved by that.
Well, anyone who has a child or knows a child understands that these challenges or moments that you bring out in the books are actually, they really relate to what kids deal with every single day. I mean, you know, trying to figure out what to do in the face of negative behavior from your peers. I mean, that's got to be something that a 10-year-old deals with, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 times a day. And to see it told in the story of someone who then a parent or a caregiver can turn around and say, "And this person went on to become the president of the United States," must be kind of making a connection which perhaps we don't see all that often or are often enough in children's literature.
I test the books out on my own kids. And when I was writing I Am Rosa Parks, I told the story, of course, about Rosa Parks when she's older on the bus. But one of the stories we have in there is that when Rosa Parks is 11 years old, a little boy comes zipping by on roller skates and shoves her, knocking her down. And he probably saw her as an easy target. But the real reason that he shoved her was he was white and little Rosa was black. And in that moment, what does she do? She shoves him back. The boy's mother comes racing up and starts yelling at her, saying, "I'll have you thrown in jail for the rest of your life." And in that moment, Rosa Parks, even at 11 years old, stands up to the bully and calmly, firmly explains to her that the boy was the one who shoved her first. And when my young son recently was bullied in his cafeteria, and my older son had read Rosa Parks, and my younger son had read it, and my older son says to my younger son, "You need to be like Rosa Parks. You need to stand up to the bully."
Wow.
And I'm just blown away that to my young son, Rosa Parks is as vital as she was all those years ago, and she's as alive today as she ever was. And that, to me, is the real goal of these books.
Mm. You know, you've said a couple times now that you really want these books to sort of inspire children to rethink what it is to be heroic. What are the examples that maybe they should consider following in their own lives? But that led me to wonder, especially in the case of Abraham Lincoln and Amelia Earhart, their stories, yes, end up being heroic, but in both those cases, their stories also end up rather tragically. I mean, as everyone knows, Abraham Lincoln is assassinated, and Amelia Earhart, in her pursuit of singular adventure and accomplishment, disappears. There's consequences to heroic behavior.
Oh, of course. I mean, and listen, it was the big decision we had to make. Here we are dealing with slavery, dealing with racism. We're dealing with major issues. But we had to decide, do we show Abraham Lincoln getting a bullet in his head? Do we show Amelia Earhart's plane crashing at the end of the book? And I can tell you, my answer came from a very simple reason. If I told my five-year-old, then five-year-old, now six-year-old, that Amelia Earhart died in a plane crash, all he is going to care about is that plane crash. And everything else she did in her life and anything else she accomplished is lost. And the books are not about how you die. The books are about how you should live. Now, as your kid gets older, here's the introductory book. And if your son or daughter or grandchild loves that story, eventually as they get a little older, then you'll lead them into the other parts of it. But if you don't introduce them in some way, they're never going to get to that part of the story. So to me, this is that first step that you can really open that door and open that window for them to crawl through.
That's Brad Meltzer talking about his children's book series, Ordinary People Change the World. We spoke to him last June. Next one in the series is called I Am Lucille Ball, and it's out later this month. Can't wait. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.